This is the answer. It would be two cases where
the mere setting of the contract, that's also an avera. Collecting is giving. Both the lender and the borrower are prohibited. This is a unique thing about ribbons. In a voluntary transaction, both the lender and the borrower violate the Torah law of ribbons. And derech halvah would be that as a precondition to the loan, the lender says that I'm lending you $1,000 and you pay me back in 3 months or 6 months, and you have to pay me back more. Whatever he stipulates. So it's kitzutza, it is stipulated merosh from the beginning. This is a derisa. Both the lender and the borrower violate Rivas' law. And another case of derisa would be if there was no interest that was stipulated that as a precondition to the loan. But when the due date arrived, the malva, either the initiative, the malva lova, they wanted to extend the date. It usually would come from the lover, so please give me some more time. And they negotiate. The Malva says, you want more time, you have to pay me some extra money for waiting longer. So that's also deraisa, even though it wasn't stipulated merosh, it was stipulated as a means to extend the loan. Now, it doesn't really make a difference if you use the lashon of interest, ribbis. The Pesachei Tshuva brings the Tshuva Ma'avra, Reza Fleckless. He says that suppose Reuben would say to Shimon that I'm giving you a gift of $1,000 and I want you in the future to give me a gift of $1,500. So even though they're talking about gifts, they're not saying the word loan, it's ribbis, that constitutes ribbis katsusa. Another case that would involve ribbis katsusa is let us say somebody has a promissory note that somebody owes him $1,000. It's not due until 3 months from now. But I need money right now. But I have this instrument that someone gave me an IOU that he's going to give me, he owes me $1,000 in 3 months from now. So what I want to do is, I want to sell it. I would be willing to sell it even at a discount to someone else. And I get cash right now, which I need. So the Shulchan Aruch says that if I would go and find a buyer and this note. The buyer says, I will not going to buy this note unless you guarantee it. He doesn't know the lover. So he says, how do I know he's going to pay? I'm not so sure about this. So I said, okay, I'll guarantee it. So if I say that I guarantee that in case of default, don't worry, I'll make good on it. If he defaults on it, I'll make good on it. That when this fellow that bought the note, when he collects the money from Lova, that's Ram Amish, Rivas Katsusa. Why? Because this is not considered to be a sale. The only time someone could consider himself to have taken over the loan to be a malva is only if he assumes the risk of default. That's how we define a malva. And the person that bought it, he is not a malva. He can't say that he bought the loan and he's the new malva. He's not the new malva. He did not assume risk at all, the risk of default. So what has happened really is only that this fellow, we'll call him Levi, that he has given me a loan of $1,000, of whatever amount of money. And I am guaranteeing that he will get back a larger sum of money. So this is Ma'amish Rivas Katsutsa. The mere fact that I want to accommodate this fellow and I'm guaranteeing the loan, that makes the purchaser, he's not the new malva, he's just a lender. And I'm guaranteeing the loan, and it makes no difference if you're a lender or you guarantee the loan. Same thing, you over Ribbis when he collects from this fellow the largest sum. So that's also Ribbis deraisa. Now, there's another case that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, which would probably be a usual case that would have possibly Ribbis deraisa. That someone stipulates the following: I'm lending you money, $1,000. I know you need the money for business venture, and you know what? If you succeed and you make money, I want a chelek of the money also. Give me 10% of your profits, so 20% of your profits. If you don't succeed, if you don't make any money, or if you lose money, the only thing I want back is the principal. So it's like a nice deal. I want to protect myself. So that's called It's called Tzad Echad Beribis, one-sided Ribis. So in other words, the two scenarios. What could happen is that the person who borrowed the money will lose and will not make a profit, and he'll just be obligated to give back the principal, what I lent him. So there's no Ribis there. That's what happens. We can't predict in advance. There's two scenarios. That's one. And the other scenario is that he does make a profit, and he has to give me part of it. So it's Sad Echot Beribis, one side. So the Machlok is the Shach and the Taz. The Taz is Machmir, and he says this is considered to be Ribis Katsutsa. And in the Shach, we usually follow the Shach, is Mekel, and he says that it is only Ribis Rabban, which has the name of Avak Ribis, the dust of Ribis. All the rabbinical extensions are called Avak Ribis. So those are the cases of Deraisa. And another case of Deraisa could be this, and this is ironically could be fixed very easily. Like you have a returns policy in a store. Store says that it says, you know, if you're not satisfied it wouldn't be Deraisa. You'll see in a minute why it's not Deraisa, because it's not stipulated in the Rosh. And it would be probably Tzad Echad. Store says that if you're not satisfied, you can return the item and it will give you back your money. And it's all they say. And so we've seen that if the customer wants to exercise the option of returning the item, so what does the customer get? He gets his money back, plus he has use of the item over this period of time. So this would definitely be Ribis. And it wouldn't be Deraisa because it wasn't stipulated in advance and it wasn't ever explicated, but it's definitely Ribis there. And we have to view the money that the customer paid as really a loan, because the customer is getting back the money plus he had use of the items. So it's very easy to fix. The store just have to say that in case you're not satisfied, we'll buy it back. And there won't be any issue about retroactively that the sale is canceled and it becomes a loan. There won't be any issue. So it's very easy to fix that. But you're saying, if you're not satisfied, we agree to buy it back. Yeah, see, it's a very difficult relationship when you have a malva and a lova, because Chachamim, they were very concerned that we shouldn't breach the Torah law, and they made various fences around the Torah. So when we deal with a lender-borrower relationship, it's a very difficult relationship, because it goes so far as to say that the lender has no right to demand favors while the relationship is intact. He's saying because I'm the lender, I can demand that you do things for me. That would be Rabbanim Asa for him to ask. You can't say it's Ribbis Katsutsa, but it's Rabbanim prohibited for him to ask. And the borrower, on his own initiative, in gratitude, he can't do favors for the Malva that he would not otherwise do. And see, this is, again, a very tricky relationship. You say if he would, they were very friendly, and he would do these things anyway. So then the Shulchan Aruch says he's allowed to do it. So you're getting into subjective judgments, like what he would do, like his whole judgment is clouded, the fact that he feels indebted to this fellow. So if he does a favor, it's a tricky thing. Maybe he would not have done the favor, but so he says, he assesses, I would do this favor anyway. But again, in a second. But in the Shulchan Aruch, it says, in Shach, that if in any case, you're not allowed to do favors for someone publicly, if it's favors done in a publicly visible manner, so then that's Rabban prohibited that. Yes, question?
Yeah. I wasn't sure. I thought you get noticed. I just have a cough. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I did have a question.
Okay.
So can the lender employ the borrower? Like, the borrower might feel sort of obligated to, how about if the lender says, hey, I need help mowing my lawn? He might feel obligated to do it, but the lender's going to pay him for a service for his time. As long as he's paying him for the other act.
As long as he doesn't make that as a condition. So if you have you're entering into the issue of Tovus Hanoah. Like let's take this case that the Malva says that I'm lending you money and you have to pay me just back the principal, no interest, but I ask you please to refer you have to do buy merchandise in my store. So he said he would buy things anyway. Let's say at a grocery store, he would buy anyway on a regular basis. So he's saying, you might, why not buy in my store? You know, see, you have to, it's a fair, my prices are no higher than the other people's prices. So that is definitely prohibited, because you say, even if you say Tovas Hanolav Mamo, so you could get into even a deraisa here if you say Tovas Hanolav, Ramos Paskins ain't a Mamo. But if you say Tovas Hanolav, so then it's a very serious thing, because it's just like stipulating that you want something extra above the principle. And it's Tovas Hanolav, what you're talking about. But if it's, see, there's one exception though. If the Malva wants to make sure that he's paid back, he could insist that the lofa should work for him, and he pays him his salary, so that way he's able to pay back the loan. That's certainly permitted. You could do something to make sure that you'll be paid back. That's reasonable. So now we get to something that is very. Let's first, yes. Yeah, it's public visible. Let's say the guy has a truck and he has his name on the truck. He lends in the truck. He's driving around it, so people see that the lender is using the borrower's truck. So it's a publicly visible thing. His name is on the truck, and the lender's driving around with it. So he's doing a favor, and it's publicly visible. So that the Rabbanim prohibited. So they're making a gather around the Torah. So We even go so far to say that it's not a question of mammon even. Like, let's say the lender would say to the borrower, you know, I'm expecting someone to arrive at the bus stop that's in front of his, it's in front of your house. There's a minimal type of kirpa. So just give me a call, like when the guy comes out of the bus. So you're not allowed to do that. That is demanding a favor, even if it's not worth any money. It's like a very minimal type of kirpa. It's also prohibited. And we have what is called even ribbis dvarim, that if the borrower cannot be maktim shalom, he's allowed to answer that because that's a courtesy. But if he was not in the practice of being maktim shalom to this fellow, so now he can't start. He's saying, like, you did me a favor, so then I have to treat you differently. To be makim shalom, you're not allowed. That's called. It's learned out. It's a nasmachta. It's not a drasha. You learn out neshach kol dava, even neshach kol dava. So the Bris Yehuda, this is probably the most prominent sefer on ribbis, Yishaya Yaakov Bloy. A lot of svarim have been written since then. I don't think they could have been written without use of his sefer. It's 1980 his sefer. So what he said, he says that what happens if somebody lends somebody money and then the borrower become and the lender become a chutanim later. So now they have different relationships. So he says it's not a problem that he should be makim shalom, because he's not doing it because of the loan, because of their relationship has changed in a basic way. So, but this is like a very difficult relationship that between a malva and a lova. And so in that rabbanim, they did other things. They said ribbis mukademes is prohibited, which means that if you want to give somebody money to soften up this fellow, that you should be willing. You have a whole plan. You want to give him a nice gift, and then a few days later you're going to come and ask for a loan. So then you have softened him up. So this is prohibited. Rabban is not derisive, because you're not. There's no stipulation here that's made, but it's done for the purpose of influencing this fellow to give the loan. So that's called ribbis mukdemes. And ribbis mucheres, let's say that just in gratitude, no, there's no stipulation that was made. Just right after the loan is paid back, the fellow feels tremendous gratitude. So he decides that he's going to give some extra money to this fellow. So the Rabban prohibited that. It was not stipulated in advance or as a condition to extend the due date. It's just on his own initiative, he gives him gratitude. So this shows you how difficult the relationship between the Malv and Lov is, because like people always have the friend. Who do you go for loan to? So usually it would be a friend. So they invite you to simchas. You go to bar mitzvah and weddings. You're giving gifts, you know. So this is really a question. So the gifts, of course, people give anyway. So it's not a problem. They want to give a much bigger gift and show gratitude. That's a big, serious problem. Giving a much bigger gift, and you get into gray areas, like your whole judgment is clouded because your relationship of being a debtor, like you don't know, like what. Is this the usual gift I would give him or not? So it's very...
That's after. That's before the loan was paid back.
No, even... Ribbis Mucheres, even after it's paid back. Even after it's paid back, Shulchan Aruch says. Even after it's paid back. You have the same question. So, but if it's a small amount, we go to the Rekiva Eger, Ramah, they say that it's okay. But I'm saying if it's a large amount, that's what I'm showing, how there could be some gray areas. That's what I'm trying to show. That when you have ribbis mucheres, a small gift, we hold like both. See, the shach and the chokhmas adam are very machmir about both ribbis mukdemes and ribbis mucheres. They both of them say the same thing, but that even a small gift before the loan or after that is in gratitude of the loan is not permitted. But we're not machmir in the halacha so much like the shach. They say that if you give a small gift afterwards, not immediately after the loan, it's okay. But a large gift, there's gray areas, like what? Why are you giving this large gift? This creates a problem.
Is this a question if it's stipulated or not stipulated?
No, even if it's not stipulated. See, this has nothing to do with stipulated making katsutsa. This is not when it's not stipulated. So we hold like the Taz, and Ramon and Rekiva Ego, they say that the small gift, even before the loan, is if it's not mentioned loan and it's their friends, they would give them anyway a gift, it's okay. But I'm saying this is a very chancy thing. There is, in the letter of the law, you're not doing anything wrong, like following the tithes, that small gift, you're not mentioning the loan, your friends, you give them occasional gifts. But I'm asking you, how many times do you all have friends? Do you just, once every 3 months, you send them a gift or something like that? Is that... It's a different culture, different society. Like, I don't know, in America, you ask yourself, how often do you give your friend gifts? You know, say, he's my friend, give him gifts. When was the last time you gave him a gift? You see, so what it says in Shulchan Aruch, it has to be looked in the modern lens of our society today. What's the mores of society today? How relationships between people are. So this is something very... very problematic, I think, the idea of gifts, because it's not usually given gifts. There is a concept called haramas ribbis that Rashba brings down, and is this called circumvention of ribbis. So this, what does it involve? That Reuven gives a loan of $1,000 to Shimon, and he says it's due in 3 months. He said, if you don't pay it on time, I want to impose upon you a penalty, a knas, of another $100. One-time penalty. It's not a penalty that would grow over time, because that's ready. It wouldn't matter what you want to call it, whatever name you want to give it. You want to call it a penalty clause. It's really ribbis. Something that Rav Nachman defines ribbis. Aga nata osarachmana. Taking money for waiting, for the return of your capital. So if you're making this case of Aramis Ribbis, it's a very narrow case, because if the fine is going to escalate with time, it's structured with time to increase, it's Mamish Ribbis Kesutza. It's no difference. The fact that I call it a fine, but I say that it's a 2% surcharge for each day of compounded interest, so that is a fine that grows with time, that's Mamish Ribbis Kesutza. But if you make a one-time penalty, so it's this is called haramas ribbis, and when it comes to derech avoa, that it's rabbanim prohibited it. But here is like a very important thing to know, that when it comes to derech mekamim, which we're going to discuss in a minute, that's really most of the subtle cases of ribbis, which is min rabbanim asa, that a one-time penalty is permitted. A penalty that does not grow. Like, let's say you have an installment plan. You say you pay upon delivery, COD, the price is $1,000. If you want to spread it out over 12 months, we make installments. And if you miss an installment, there's going to be a penalty. So if it's a one-time thing, it's okay to do that because it's derech mekach chomemcha. It is ribbis. It's only avak ribbis. It's not ribbis derisive. So this concept of a fine, a one-time fine, is permitted, but it's not very helpful. We'll see, because merchants are not satisfied with that. Just to make there's 10, there's 12 installments, and if you miss what you pay a certain amount, they like it to grow with time. That's what the merchants would prefer. Yes.
Yes. For example, the lender gave a loan.
Yeah.
And he took it out of his home equity line, which he knows that he's going to charge him a certain percentage per month for that loan that he gave to someone. Is he entitled to incur that loss?
That's not a clear thing. Let's say somebody had a CD. I think this is what you're asking. A CD, and you had to keep it in the bank. Let's say for 6 months, and they have a penalty to say that if you withdraw early, you incur a penalty. So he wants to, somebody's pressing him for a loan. He says, "All right, you want a loan." So I'll have to go and liquidate my CD and incur a penalty, and I want you to pay the penalty. So this exact thing that the most achronim would say that this is not permitted to cover yourself, because it's the same thing as, so let's say somebody agrees to sell an item, a liquidated item, below the market price. So it's past history. It has nothing to do with this fellow. Why should he? This is not something that he could pass on to the borrower. There are achronim that say, and Rabbi Yisrael Reisman in his sefer has this issue, and he brings some achronim that do permit it, but the majority don't, because it's not something that that you could pass on to the lover.
He's incurring a loss on the
account. Yeah, but he doesn't have to do it. Once he does it, he's giving him money, and he's asking him to give him back more. It's not a loss that has anything to do with the. See, if you give somebody would give you a bad check, for instance, so you could tell the person to pay the penalty because he caused you. He's a grummer. He caused the penalty. But here you're undertaking to give a loan, and you're doing it b'toras chesed, that you're willing to incur this penalty. But it's not something that the Lova caused you. Yes, he's Brahma, Garmi. There's nothing to do with it. It's all part of my chesed. I'm willing to go so deeply in chesed to do, but that doesn't permit interest. If I want to do chesed to you, that doesn't permit me to charge you interest on that. It's a bigger chesed, but it's not. I think that's the svar. All right. So so there are many.
I have one more question. How many gains in a sense? I'll give you an example. I gave a loan on my credit card. If you wanted money, I charged you my credit card and I incurred the points to go travel with it.
Oh, okay. See, that's also discussed. That's something that has nothing to do. Is the question that if you use somebody's credit card, so then the person who owns the credit card will gain because of points. So is that considered to be ribbis that the person took the credit card? No, it's not, because it's not something that the lova confers on the malv. It's something that the credit company confers upon him. He just triggered it, but he has nothing. He is not the one that confers that. It's the usage of the malv. It's not considered direct enough to be considered that it's something that the lova gave the malv. But that's something that people. It's a very important thing. The Mishnah's Ribbis, Rabbi Luami, he talks a lot about this. I know him personally. He's one of the Rosh HaKolim in Torah V'das. He has a very good sefer in Ribbis. He talks about this, about the credit card. You know, when if you give someone your credit card, so the credit card company is only lending money to the owner of the credit card. So they don't lend it to anyone that you approve of as the owner giving it to someone. So when the person that uses the credit card, so what is really happening is that the owner is lending the fellow the money, and when there's a charge for past the grace period, there's a charge. When, if, in other words, the worst case would be if the one that says, you know, I'll pay all the charges also. So that's mamish rivet susa, because the loan is not coming from the non-Jewish credit card company. It's coming from the owner of the credit card. That's the mechanics of it. You have no right. They don't approve a loan to this third party because the owner of the credit card says it's okay. They only give it to the fellow who owns the card, and it's on. He's the one that's being the borrower, and he wants to lend the money to someone else. So it's and this fellow is agreeing to pay the money, the interest on. So that's would be Rivas Katsutsa. Yeah, so it had, and if somebody wants to borrow money and say, well, for sure, I'll pay back before this interest accumulates. But then what happens? He doesn't do it. He's negligent. He doesn't do it. So then Rabbi Almi says that he thinks that this would not be a prohibition of ribis mulcheres. That you, in that case, you could give a gift to this fellow that in that instance that it would not be violate ribis mulcheres. Well, he didn't know because he agreed in advance to pay back on time, and then he just, it's his own fault. It was his action that caused there to be, as you could say, uh-huh, that is a grama. There's no in Nezikim, there's no chiv at all there. There's no chiv, but to say that he wants to pay him back, it's not paying him ribbons. He just wants to make good for his loss. That's what really what it amounts to, because he's making good for a loss that way, not paying aganata the way. Yes.
In case you just said that it would be a problem where the person who borrows a credit card and be paying fees.
It was if he agrees to say, you know, I'm borrowing, I'm not going to pay. I'll pay you back in a few months. It knows that right. He's going to be kicking in the interest in the credit card because of his use of it. He says Marosh that he's going to pay. I'll pay all the fees that you have on account of my expenditure. So that's Mamash Rivas Katsutsa, to agree to that.
If he's paying to the credit card,
doesn't matter, because we have Rivas Katsutsa would be, suppose say somebody borrows, lends somebody money and says, you know, I want you to pay me back. Now I give you $1,000, you pay me back $1,200, but the extra $200 you give it to this fellow. Same thing, it's no difference. Yeah, give it to me or someone else, it's no difference. See, but here's a very important point about a third party, that this happens all the time. Rabban should know this, that what happens if somebody would come to you and say, you know, I didn't know the law about ribis, and I agreed to pay ribis, this guy, to borrow money and interest. The fellow that you're borrowing from is a secular Jew, not a religious Jew. So what am I going to do? I'm going to come back to him and say to him, I'm sorry, my rabbi said that the whole thing was wrong, and I only could pay you the principal, I can't pay you the interest. So how are you going to get out of this situation? So the Eitzah is that the only thing the Torah prohibited is ribis habor melov lemalva. So if it's not a lot of money, you prevail upon people as a chesed. You say, you know, this guy's going to be a son of Israel. You know, say, you know what? The arrangement is, you know, it'll tell this fellow that you're going to get. Don't worry, you'll get what was agreed to, but you're not going to get it from the borrower. That someone else is going to give it to you. So as long as this was not prearranged before, that don't tell that this is after the fact. So it's not a question of someone ribis mukdemis, like someone saying, you know, here. See, that's also if somebody takes their own initiative and says, you know, here's $200, lend Ruve money without interest, or else he wouldn't lend him altogether. But he's getting $200, he's pretty sure he'll get back the principal. Now he's satisfied. So that is perfectly okay for someone to do that in his own initiative. And here, when someone got stuck like this, if someone without being requested to be reimbursed, if the fellow is not going to be requesting to be reimbursed, but there's no prohibition for the lova on his own to give this third party who did him a favor that he was, you know, he was ready to do this anyway, to give this loan, the secular Jew was willing to give him $1,200. So if he wants on his own to reimburse the good Samaritan that did it for him, the Baal Chesed that did it for him, there's nothing wrong with it, because he's not giving it to the Malva, he's giving it to someone else, and this is the way out of that situation. Another thing that's very important about after the fact is what happens if you entered into a ribis contract with somebody and you began to pay ribis, what do you do? So Rav Moshe has a tshuva and says that calls mind that you didn't pay up the principal, anything that you paid is regarded as principal, not interest. even if you call it interest, you say, here's the interest payment, but you didn't pay up the principal yet. You borrowed $1,000. You didn't pay back the $1,000. So he says, so this is a very good ASA that you catch it in time. A transaction that is prohibited, no harm is done, really. Because you say, well, what I gave you should be regarded as principal, and we're not allowed to charge interest, so we have to cancel it. So as I said, if it works, it doesn't work, we could do the eitzah of getting a third party to pay. And then the lova, if he wants one, his own accord, could reimburse, no problem. But he can't promise to do so, because then it's already ribbis. If there's no duty, no legal duty or more or promise in that effect, then it's okay. All right. So now there are a lot of different transactions that in Rabbanim that involve ribbis that Rabbanim made. And we have, for example, we have this case, a case of and the way business is done. It's very, maybe you might be familiar with this. It's an invoice that's 210 net 30. So that's how it's done. So what does it mean? 210 net 30. I have a board there, right at the end.
Oh, we have. This is how invoices are done. 210 net 30. Better one. Okay, then. So this is how an invoice is done. So what does it mean? It means that you have some money on the invoice, let's say it's $1,000, you say that if you're going to pay within 10 days, you get 2% off. Within 10 days, you get 2% off. If you pay anytime from 10 to 30 days, after the 10 days, you have to pay what it says on the invoice. That's how it works. So the question is, What is this? How is this to be understood? So Rabbi Reisman in his sefer, he has a whole arichas in this, how different ways to look at it. But his conclusion is that we have to view the price that's written on the invoice as a credit price. You can't view the price as take off 2%, say that's the price, and then this price that's written on the invoice is a penalty. It's the price plus the penalty. Derech HaSochem, the business people, do not look at it that. They all look upon this 210 net 30, what it says on the invoice, that is a credit price. And so therefore, what you're really doing with this invoice, clearly, is you're establishing a two-tier pricing system. You're saying to the fellow that if you want to pay cash, so you can deduct 2%, and if not, you want to have it on credit, so you have to pay what it says here. So you can't say that so this really is definitely prohibited. I don't know, a lot of it's not, because you can't view it as a fine, you can't, and so you need, what we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, you need a hetter iska, really, if you want to do business like that. 210 net 30, you need to have a hetter iska.
How about why that's he's taking the loss.
Well, it's head to ISCO, you can accomplish exactly the same thing. You see, what the person gives you, will the head to ISCO will accomplish exactly the same thing that you want with this document, the 210 net 30.
Why isn't it regarded as a regular sale discount?
It's because the way business people, the way they view it, that's what the bottom line is. You know, you can go read into it anything you want. To say that you're not doing anything wrong. The question is, like, we ask objectively business people, what how do they view this? They would say that the price that's written on the invoice is a credit price, a price that if you want to buy the item on a 30-day, up to 30 days credit, and the 210 is a discount from the credit price if you pay right now. But the price, it is definitely a credit price. So what it's stating is a two-tier price system of a cash price and a credit price. And that's exactly what you're not allowed to do. And you see, this is Derech Mekach Memka. This is not Teraisa. If you say you pay COD, this is the price you want to pay on installments, this is. This is not saying that you want to pay, have the grace period, not paying immediately. You pay any time from the 10th day of receipt of the merchandise to 30 days, this will be the price that you pay. So it's a credit price. It's not the cash price plus a penalty. I mean, that is Sur Yaakov. He calls it Sur Yaakov. They want to view it that way. But it's factually wrong. That's not how business people look at it. That's easy to be more heta to say, get out of this very, very easily that way. So so that's one thing we have. Now, we have also, oftentimes, you get a discount if you prepayment. If you pay before delivery, we'll give you a discount. Now, this is a little more subtle. Like, why would this be objectionable? Because this, you're not obligated to pay until the merchandise is delivered. So what's going on here? Why are you paying before it's being delivered? And to compound it, Gemara says that Dvar Torah, Kesef Kona, that when you want to effect a transaction with Metaltalim, that one of the Kinyanim is Kesef. You give a deposit. That's fine. That's a Kinyan. But the Rabbanim removed it. They say Kesef ain't a Kona because we're afraid that if a store could have different items that people gave deposits and they're waiting for delivery or pickup, and what would happen if a fire would break out in the premises of the seller? So you say, Nisfu chitecha baliyah, too bad, your item burns. And what are you going to do with this fellow? He doesn't have to be mosher nefesh to save the item. And so he won't want to exert himself to the maximum that he can, because he knows that there's already a kinyan, kesef, and the balance is owed by this buyer. And he'll say, you owe me the balance. So if it would be his own item, yeah, you say, what does Gemara say? Adam Bohol Amamono. I have to save, do whatever I can to save my property. I'll do anything I can to save. So Rabban saw, their insight of human nature, they felt that this would happen often enough. So they said, Kesef ain't a kona. You have to make a different Kenyan Mashicho that owes... or Kinyan Suda, that always helps for everything. Kinyan Suda is an all-purpose Kinyan. So, what's going on here? Why is this fellow paying before delivery? And if there's a money cash, kesef, that doesn't accomplish anything in terms of Kinyan of Metaltalim, except Lenyan Bishapara does accomplish, because there's anticipation on the part of the party that it'll be consummated. So if somebody wants to renege at that point, so they have to be in Mekabel Bishapara. But in terms of acquiring the object, it doesn't do anything. So, what it looks like? It looks like a disguised loan. And what's happening here is that the buyer is advancing a loan to the customer, to the merchant, and the merchant will pay him back in merchandise that's more valuable than the money that was advanced to him, because he's giving him a discount because he's paying earlier. So the merchandise that's delivered will be more valuable than the money that the customer gave him in advance. So it looks like, what's going on here. It's a disguised loan. So the Rabbanim prohibit, this is one of the cases of Avak Ribbis. So, but there are two exceptions to this. One, if we have what is called Yesh Lo, that if the merchant has in stock this merchandise, then it's okay to do this. Because, there's nothing, the Rabbanim are only coming here to put a gather around the Torah. Now, Yesh Lo, if he has it, so then you can't say that, why should you look at it as a disguised loan? If somebody could sell anything he has at any price he likes, is there any question? I could give you a bargain basement price and anything I have. So if I want to do that, it's my liberty as the sales, as a seller to do this. And if Yesh Lo, I have, that's how the Chochmas Adam understands it. He says, if Yesh Lo, then it's the sale. And any kind of deep discount that the seller wants to make to this one or that one, it's no problem at all. He could do that. So that's one heter of Yesh Lo. But Rabbanim, interestingly enough, said that you could use the same merchandise and stock for multiple transactions. So so you say that I could deliver it to you right now, but I'm using the same backup, the same merchandise in the warehouse that I have, I'm using that as a basis to offer the same deal to many, many people. So I'm using the same item that I have in stock. So why is this okay? This looks like a sham, you say. Like, what? Does it have to work perfectly? No, because Rabbanim are just not there to make new prohibitions. You can't make new prohibitions. You're just making a fence around the Torah. So once we remove the appearance of a disguised loan, it's fine. It doesn't matter that you're using the same yesh lo, you're using it for many transactions. It was a question, yeah.
There's no time element to it. If it's just, sometimes you walk into a store and because they're paying, they have to pay 2% to the credit card, use your credit card. So they'll say, look, if you pay me cash, I'll knock off 2% off the price because I'm going to save that money by not having to pay it to Visa. But there's no time element, there's no 10, 30 days, there's no
date. Yeah, so we've seen any kind of transaction where it's just of that sort that you're saying is agonata. Rivas is agonata. It's taking money for waiting for the... So if this is just a question of that if you can eliminate a certain cost of the seller, I don't see why that should be, wrong. Because it's not agonat at all. So one is the yesh lo, and the other is that suppose the item that you're selling is not a standardized item. It's like it could be, let's say, it's a car, a used car, or it's a custom furniture. There's no identical items. So we can't really say, so there's a different rationale here why it's not a problem, a pre-delivery discount. Why is that a problem? Because you don't have a standardized item to refer to. So that it could very well turn out that the seller, that he will deliver an item that will actually match the cash that the customer advanced. There is no standardized item. So what he actually ends up with could very well be equal and be value this, of that exactly what he advanced him. There's a very big difference between the two exceptions, yesh lo, and when we're dealing with a product that is not standardized. That yesh lo, you could give any discount you want, doesn't matter, because it's the svar of the chokhmas adam that you're actually you have it, so you could make any price that you want, you can make any kind of discount to a particular customer that you want. But if you're using the heter saying that, well, it's not really a disguised loan because who's to say that when I deliver the merchandise it will not be the same value as the money advanced? So then you cannot make a deep discount, and that's understood to be more than 20%. Because then it would just be circumventing the Rabbanim's prohibition. By giving such a big, then it does look like a disguised loan. So you can't make a big one, 20%. Now this raises an issue, an everyday question, that this prohibition about magazine subscriptions. So you find very often that a publisher will offer a discount for a 2 or 3 year subscription off the newsstand price, right? Now let's analyze that. That type of deal. We have many Jewish publications. They will offer that deal. They will offer you a deep discount from the newsstand price or the price of the launch of sending you individually. So what kind of cases are we talking about the magazine? Is it a case of something that's standardized and therefore it would be yesh lo? It makes any sense at all. They're not even produced yet, these magazines. It's a double shlova olam. There's no possibility. You can't call this yesh lo. They have to first be created, right? So, how could he do this? What kind of heter is there? We're dealing with a standardized product and ain lo, the biggest ain lo you could imagine. He doesn't have it. So how could he make this thing? So when Yishai Yaakov Blow in the Sefer Bris Yehuda, he says that. Here, this is very related to the question that you asked before about the whole prohibition of rivers is agonata, that you're taking money for waiting. So it is evident that the publisher is not making this deal because you're offering him money in advance before it's due, before he receives the copies in the mail. He's giving you money in advance. So no, that's not the reason. He's doing this because you are committing yourself to buy the magazine for a long period of time, and that's worth him something. So to elaborate, what he means is like you go to a newsstand, you'll see Yotei Neman, you'll see what's the competitor? Hamadiya, right? It's in the Jewish press, all these things. So every week I'll look at the front page. It's appealing to me. This week I'll pick up more Hamadiya, and this week I'll pick up the Arte and Jewish press, whatever I catch my fancy that week. This way I'm committing myself to buy it for a long time. So this is, that's why he's getting the discount. Not because I'm giving money in advance, because he can rely on my patronage for a sustained period of time. That's what Rav Shai Yaakov Bloy said. I would want to add to that, that today the whole profit of newspapers you get from advertisements. And these people that advertise, they want to know profile, they want to see that they are committed people to buy. So they want, and they actually, you could tell, this is a whole science, operations research, you could just tell by the addresses of the people a lot about them, like neighborhoods, what kind of income they have, and whether it's profitable for me to advertise. This is a whole science. So this is very valuable to viability of the whole business, that to sell subscriptions. Nothing to do with getting advance payment. This is how I attract advertisers, that I can show I have these people that are subscribers, and actually I could describe them. I have some information about them. I have their addresses, maybe I have something else about them. Sometimes the people, they write in that they're a doctor, a professor, something that rabbi, you know, so they know something about these people, and it's very valuable. So this is not a question of agonata. So pre-delivery, the subscriptions are okay. And by the way, like, you have some Torah journals that do the same thing, and there it's more fundamental, that it's no problem whatsoever, because Torah journal is the remark quotes the Rashba and says that as far as Avok Rivas is concerned, that so we're talking about Somim and a Mosad of Torah, that they are allowed to pay the people that manage their estate. They're allowed to pay Avok Rivas or accept Avok Rivas for the benefit of the Somim. So in other words, the Rabbanim did not prohibit this. They allowed them to accept, to get Avok Rivas as an investment, because they didn't want to make such stringencies to someone that is an apitravis for Yisomer. So this would apply, I think, for the Torah journals as well, that there's no problem whatsoever, because this is just Avok Rivas, and they're not prohibited at all. Yeah. Okay, now... Yeah, we wanted. This is a very important thing about a poel and a kabbalah. So a poel is, you say, ain't schirs meshalemes el b'sof. Somebody is hired as a worker, so he's paid at the end of the wage period, just like any rental, according to Dina Gemara. Any rental or schirs is paid at the end. So if you want to give someone advance payment before he begins work, so that's, that is just like a pre-delivery discount. You say, you know, we've been giving you, before you start work, we give you a salary, and because we're giving it to an advance, you should agree to a lower salary. So this is what the Shulchan Aruch says. You're not allowed to do that. That is Avok Rivas, to offer a discount, to offer a worker, to pay him a lower salary, and paying him before he starts work. That is not allowed. That's Avok Rivas. Now, the Shulchan Aruch makes a distinction between a poel and a kabbalah. Thanks. So what the difference is that a poel, once he agrees to work with a kinyan, as opposed to dvarim, because he could renege. He just yeshalov tarumos. If he just agreed and didn't make a kinyan, so he can renege from what he's doing. Just depending upon whether he puts out the balabais, it'd be yesh lo tarumas or not. But if there's a kinyan, so that's where there is a difference between a poel and a kabbalah. Anytime someone just says b'amira, he agrees to work, that's gemara in Shulchan Aruch and gemara that is yesh lo tarumas, if you want to renege. But if you make a kinyan, then you can't renege. But there's a difference. A poel can renege, because Mar says Barbasir, Kili Avadim, Blo Avadim Avadim. A poel is allowed to renege even b'chatzia yom, without penalty. Let's say he agreed to work for $10 an hour, for 8 hours, and then after 4 hours he wants to quit. So what happens? The employer has to hire a new replacement worker, and let's say the wage rate went up by $5 an hour. So there's an extra $20. So that does not come out of the poll that reneged. He, without penalty, he could renege. Because Kili Avadim Lava, the poll is in his the relationship that he establishes with the employer with working fixed hours is akin to servitude. It's shackled, and he can't have freedom to go away. So the Torah does not want him to feel psychologically that he's shackled or bound to his employer. So they allow him to renege without penalty. Of course, it's not an absolute privilege. If he wants to renege to get a high-paying job elsewhere, it's not recognized. If he's an Osek and Dover Harvard, he's something that if he doesn't give it immediate attention, the Baal Bais will incur a loss, material loss, so that he can't do it. But it's an abstract of privilege, which makes psychologically it makes the worker feel good that he's not bound, he's not shackled. So he can renege, as opposed to a Koblen who is paid for the finished product. Although he has deadlines, everyone has deadlines, you know. So a Koblen is defined as someone that has some flexibility in choosing his hours. He has, let's say, somebody wants a suit, the old time suit, have commissioned him before Yontif, I want my suit. So it's ready 2 days of Yontif, you're not even finished at all. You're not even close to finishing. So he can't, the Koblen cannot renege and say, I'm not going to finish the job, and if you have to hire someone else to complete the job, so he will face penalties. And the big machlokes in the Shulchan Aruch, we're not going to go into it, like what the nature of the penalties. At the very least, he could lose what he already earned. There's a machlokes, the shachos, even out of pocket, he could lose it as well. It's unlikely the wage rate goes up so high, but that's possible. So we have a difference between a Koblen and a Poel, and that makes all the difference here between making such a deal of saying, you know what, we agreed to a price, how about accepting a much lower price if I give you in advance of your starting work? Now, so if you offer this to the Poel, since he's allowed to renege, theoretically, he has this right to renege, even though he made a kinyan and you want to make this dual wage rate deal with him. So since he can renege, you can't say that he's obligated to work now, that he started to work now. He could always renege. So, and you can't say that he has begun his work. So you can't offer him a discount for accepting earlier, because it has to be viewed as what? As a loan. And how is the worker going to be paying back the employer? With work that's worth more than the money that he's giving him in advance. He's not obligated to work. He could renege at any time. So you're giving him money before he starts. What is this? It's a loan, really. It's a disguised loan. And the worker is paying back with his toil and effort. That's what which is worth more money. So this is prohibited. On the other hand, a Koblen cannot renege. Once he makes a kinyan, you make a kinyan with him, he cannot renege. Because he's not akin to an Evan. He's paid for a finished job. So since he cannot renege, you can't. There's no reason to view the money that you're offering him now as a loan. He is already obligated to be a worker. And why should the Rabbanim view it as a loan that the employer is giving him and being paid back with services? So this is the difference, the Shulchan Aruch, between a Koblen and a Poel. Now there's a whole question that whether a Koblen is considered to be a Koblen when he doesn't do the work himself. Let's say he hires other workers. Do we say the same leniency in the Shulchan Aruch about making this deal? Does it apply only if the Koblen himself is going to do the work? Or let's say he's just a middleman, essentially, that he will put together all the work that has to be done. The contractor that will put together all the workers. Do we give him the same? Can you work the same thing? So, Rabbi Yashiv says that it's no difference at all. That's his view. That someone who hires other people to do the work, and since they're paid for, he's paid for the finished job, for not, and there's no fixed hours that he's obligated to do. He's not considered to be as a poel. He's a kabbal. Even though people that work for him, they're all poel. Doesn't make a difference. You're making the deal with a kabbalah, so there's no difference. But that he's hiring people and they're all poel. No difference at all. But I think this is really a very good method. When you have an issue about here in a yeshiva about giving loans, student loans, you know, so you say, how could you give loans and charge interest on loans, right? And then this whole issue about giving, you can't make heter iska. I think that's difficult here, because I was picking up this question over the years and saying heter iska is like the most right away, what hits you is the easiest way to do this. But it's like it's a question of government and non-Jewish students. So it's having one method with the Jewish students and with the non-Jewish students. There's a whole question, legal questions and practical questions there. It seems to me like this is with Eliashiv, what he says, that if you hire a kabbalah and make a kinyan with him, even though he himself is not doing the work, he's have poalim under him, he's considered to be a kabbalah job, and he's can't renege because you made a kinyan. We're talking about making kinyan suvi. You make a kinyan suvi. The Baal Bais gives him a handkerchief. The kabbalah takes it, and he says, and the Baal Bais says to him, by taking the handkerchief from me, this is symbolic barter. You obligate yourself to do the job. So it's like a symbolic barter. That's what a kinyan suvi is. So whose handkerchief? The Baal Bais. And see, the kabbalah doesn't have to really give it back. The minhag is to give it back because it's really symbolic barter, so you could keep it. The kabbalah could keep the handkerchief, and by me getting something from you, I allocate to do something for you. But the minhag is to give it back. Okay, so it seems to me like this is would be an etzah. Like you've established two types of payment systems for people that pay tuition, the people that will be paying. After you start getting the educational services, nobody pays everything in a lump sum. You pay anyway in installment, right? Anyway, so there's a monthly thing. A monthly installment. How does it work? Monthly installment. However they do it. So, but that's for one group of people that want to pay after they get the services and on an installment basis. And then there are the people that will pay. That will pay earlier. So there's a different payment schedule for them. Let's say the first payment could start a little earlier before the service is rendered. So we could have these two schedules, and we could be willing to lend money to people based on the higher schedule. We're going to make definitely make people that are going to be paying. The only difference that we can do for them is we're going to start a little earlier, so then it could be a dual system of paying early. But it's not; it's only paying early, not in a nominal way that would be just regarded as showing your good faith. That's not really paying earlier; saying pay a small amount of money. You pay the first installment is before the school year starts, and that would be manageable for all the people that. I don't think it would be very different at all, maybe just by a few days or a week, people that actually pay the tuition and don't borrow. But the people who want to get a loan, they would be subject to the higher payments schedule that would be set out for later payments. And it doesn't have to be a big difference in when everything is due. But there's two schedules here. There is, we would one called early, but it's early only in the sense that the first payment is a little early and the other one is the regular schedule, but it's harder. So we're not making any burden on the people that are actually paying, not changing what they're accustomed to now. Maybe just we're making the dates a little bit early, and we're making the first schedule payment is a little higher, and the other people are paying are the ones that borrow the money. So we say we agree to lend you money if you want to pay. In other words, you're not paying early. You want to pay regularly. That personally, you want to pay early? No. You want to pay after? I don't have money So you okay? You don't have money. We'll lend you the money, and that will be all the payments that are made from the second type of schedule, and that's how you do it for everybody. And that way, you establish a dual price system, and the higher price system are the people that you lend the money to, and you just lend them as much as they need, but it's a higher price. It's a price that's spread out of 12 payments, but it's a higher price. And the people that don't borrow, they have a different schedule, which is just slightly off in terms of the days when everything is due, and so maybe the first one is a little higher and a little earlier. That's how I think it would be arranged, and it would be no problem discriminating against people. And because you're allowed to make a dual payment schedule when the principal, the people that are running, the administrators are really arranging all the educational services, the cobbler, right? All the teachers and everything, everything has to be done. They are doing it. So even though the teachers are poal, I'm a poal, have to work, come to the class and so on. But the person that arranges it, well, the administrators, they are kablan for sure. So you're arranging with them, and Eliyahu says it doesn't matter that they don't do the work themselves. They don't do the teaching themselves. They are hiring people. But you have two schedules. One is higher than the other, and you lend money to people who want to pay later. And you say you give them option paying early, pay later. So of course they say, I can't pay early. I can't even pay later. Okay, you can't pay on a later schedule, we'll lend you the money, but it's a higher price. Each month it's higher. It takes into account the interest that you want to pay. Two dual price system. Yes.
I don't understand the difficulty to begin with. Yeah. In my understanding, the vast majority of student loans come from the federal government anyway. So once I'm borrowing from the federal
government. That's not so. There are a lot of private loans. No, that's the first thing I hear. What's the problem? No, it's not so. There are private loan funds also. There is federal money too, true. And that's big difficulty when people give private money to establish different rules. This is very difficult to implement. This might be an idea. Okay, now, we got to go right into Het Isco. We got to spend a lot of time on that. So now let's go to Het Isco. So Het Isco is a way to fix up a lot of all these transactions that you say that are prohibited can easily be fixed up with a Het Isco. Now, so Het Isco is embellishment of the partnership arrangement, which is called Isco, which is discussed in Bar Bamtia Daf Kufdal. What is an Isco? It is an arrangement where it's a partnership arrangement where you have a silent partner who is the investor, the financier, and he has nothing to do with the business at all, nothing. He's not a decision maker and not a person that's a manager or a worker. He's just a financier. We call him a silent partner. He has nothing to do with business. He gives money to someone else, another fellow. We call him the managing partner, and that person is involved in the business in every manner. It's a manager, worker, decision maker, right? And they have, since he's a financier, A is a financier, so they make an arrangement and how to split the profits and the losses. So, ordinarily, when both of the partners work, Chazal do not interfere of how they should arrange the profits and the losses. They can do it any way they want. As you know, you can have a business, one fellow can be the brains, the other one's the brawn, so they can have a very lopsided arrangement of profits and losses, favoring the person that is the whole brains of the business, right? Chazal didn't have anything to say about that. Do whatever you want. But if one is a financier and he has nothing to do with the business and he is giving money, capital, to someone else who is the manager of the business, so you cannot exploit the managing partner. This is another extension of avak ribbis. You can't put the guy that you're giving money to over the barrel, because it's very much akin to a loan. It's not a loan. There are partners in a business, but it has the appearance of the same type of thing. Like you have him over the barrel, he doesn't have any money. So if you give him a loan, you're not allowed to take interest. So if you give him capital, you're a partner, then you're allowed to do whatever you want with him, to exploit him any way you want. So Chazal said, no, we cannot divide the profits and losses any way you want. We have say the following. It has to be a symmetrical division of profits and losses, meaning that however, whatever percentage you, the financier, want to take of the profits, you have to give the same percentage, assume the same percentage of the losses. So the Gemara says, Stam iska, you don't say anything, it's a magic word, iska. So we understand that Stam iska would be half, would be a 50-50 arrangement, where the profits are split in half and the losses are going to be split in half. But if you want to, you could say any symmetrical division profit losses would be okay. If you want to take 90% of the profits, you have to say to the managing partner, there are losses, I will assume 90% of the losses. That's okay also. It has to be symmetrical. But if you want to make it karv l'schar, v'roch l'hesed, you want to make it that it's near to profit and far from loss from your standpoint, that's Rabbanim prohibited. That's all the grace. We make karv. Oh, thank you. Okay, so the red one. Karv l'schar, v'roch l'hesed. This is avak ribis, rabban prohibited. In other words, you want to make an asymmetrical arrangement that I take, let's say, 90% of the profits, and if there are losses, I'll only take 10% of the losses. That's a very mean type of arrangement, but that's what rabban prohibited. It has to be symmetrical. That's one thing. The second thing that they did is, and here's a very subtle thing, that what distinguishes a pikadon, a trust, from a loan. What's the difference? If I give someone something as a pikadon, that you should watch for me, or I give you money as a loan, what's the difference? The difference is chaya ba'onsin. That is the nafka mina, right? That if I give you something as a trust, you're a shomer. You can be a shomer chidish, but some depends on the arrangement. But if I give you money as a loan, no matter what happens to the money, you can have the biggest unavoidable circumstances. So I gave the money to spend it, and she returned to me. So whatever happens to the money doesn't matter. You must return, give me back the principal, right? So chayav onsin is what distinguishes the pikadon from the halva. So therefore, what Gemara says, high iska is palga milva, palga pikadon. We could call it half loan, half trust, because they have to divide. We just assume that it's a code. They want a word. They want to divide profits and losses equally, right? And so they didn't say otherwise. So it means it has to be symmetrical. So you don't say anything. You just say stam iska. His money, the Torah says iska. So you mean it should be divided equally, the profits and the losses. So there is a portion of this capital transfer that has the status of a loan, because there's a half of the money the recipient, the managing partner, is responsible for. What is the distinguishing feature of a loan is chayav ba'onsin. The person who receives it, it has to return no matter what. So we must characterize half of the money that the misasek, the managing partner, is receiving as having the status of a halva, right? So now we have a question. He's getting money from this financier, and he is the and who is working in the business? Only the managing part. The other fellow silent, right? You're working for nothing. Who works for nothing? You're working in a store, in a business, and you're not getting any wages. Whoever heard of such a partnership? So really, it's not such a serious question, because people maybe would work for nothing with a chance to make a profit. But it still doesn't look kosher here. It doesn't look right. Rabbanim said, if you're making an iska arrangement and one of the partners is just silent, financier, you must give, Rabbanim made this takon, and he say, you must give the misasek a schar tircha. You must give him some money for wages. Because if not, it looks like he agrees to work for nothing as a means to get the loan. Because you have to characterize half of the money as a loan, because it's chayav onsin, right? So that's what it looks like. It looks like he's agreeing to work for nothing in order to get the loan. And so we have to give a schar tircha. Now, this is all midrabanan, because some people would work for nothing just for the chance of getting a profit, right? Because no one else would give them money, right? So rabbanan would make this takana, right? So if they agree in advance to do this, so Rabbanim are not here to make trouble, to make life hard. They just don't want us to breach the Torah law. So Schar Tircha, the Shulchan Aruch says, could be a dinar, that, that and for the whole period of time. So dinar is this is from say it's 4.8 grams of silver, and if silver is $7 an ounce, so it's $1.08. Silver is a lot more today, more like $14. So that's, but we don't look at the Shulchan Aruch says that's what you have to give him. But almost all the Achronim say that you give him even a pruta, it's enough. So the minute today is just to put a dollar down for the Schar Tircha. Now, this is like some people just leave it out in the form of the Het Iska, and they say, oh, you know, they don't put it in there. It's a very serious business if you don't put it in there. So if you look what it says in Shulchan Aruch, Shach, what you do, if let's say you forgot to do that. You didn't do it. So then, you know what you'd have to do. You would have to figure out what the competitive wage is for this type of work for this guy who's doing for 10 months, whatever it is, and pay it. That's what the Shah says. But the Mishnah's Ribbis, Sefer, he comes out of the room, he says that no, that you don't really have to. The Shah himself says that if we have a custom of what is usually paid for a certain type of work, so that's how we would handle it, ex post. We didn't pay it in advance. So it's a fact. This is what, in an ISCA arrangement, this is what is done, a dollar. So therefore, loy no ra, nothing terrible to have. If you leave it out, you can fix it by giving the dollar afterwards. That's the bottom line, if you give him. But it has to be put in. That's really part of the thing. Now, that's what the Gemara talks about. Now, comes along Nachman Levigdor in 1550 in Krakow. He decides that we could go and make some embellishments of this basic structure of Iska that's mentioned in the Gemara to make it attractive for a financier to give all the capital to a managing partner. Yes?
Just a question about Pasi Lobo, Pasi Kano. How does that structure account for the fact that he gets profits? It explains why he gets half the losses, but why does he get half the profits?
Well, that's the arrangement they made. When someone, Chacham say, if you give over money to make a partnership with someone else, that's the idea of a partnership, that you share profits and losses. But the question is, how do you share it? In a symmetrical way or an asymmetrical way? So in an ordinary partnership, when both work, you could make any arrangement you want. But the idea is to make a partnership. So you have to, the Rabbanim say that when you make this partnership, you have to make it symmetrical. And Stam Iska is chasi milva, chasi begotten. The idea is to share the profits and the losses in some manner. That's what a partnership is. The Rabbanim made restrictions. They say that you want to make a partnership, it must be in a symmetrical way. And stam milva, stam iska is chasi milva, chasi begotten. Yeah.
I still don't understand the
mitzvah. Yeah.
If someone's a silent financier,
gives it money.
Money.
Yes.
So he's getting still.
So what does he get? If it would be a loan, the whole thing would be unacceptable. But it's not a loan. He's making a partnership with this managing partner. He says, I give the money, you provide the brawn. Okay? That's the partnership. So Rabbanim say, wait a second, you're setting up a mechanism that really is very akin to a loan relationship, right? It's very similar, but it's not the same. So we just can't let it go unregulated. We have to say that you can't give money karvus ha rochel hefset because that is exploiting the fellow, and it's like ribbis, like it's not ribbis, but it's like ribbis. And also, you must give him schar tircha because then it looks like he's working for nothing to get the capital transfer in the first place. Rabbanim made those two regulations, okay? Yeah. So what het iska is built on iska to make it attractive for the malva to give, we don't call malva, the financier, to want to give money to this fellow. How do we make it attractive for him to do that? We make some embellishments here. We say, when you give somebody money, as Bataris Iska, aren't you entitled to reports of how the business is doing? You're entitled to that. You're the financier. I want to get reports. I'm giving the money for a year. So I want monthly reports or semi-annual reports, right? And then I can tell you how I want to report profits and losses. This is what his innovation is, Rabbi Nachman Levigdor. He said, make it a matter
where we can predict in advance that the financier will end up with a profit and will somehow protect the principal and he won't get lost. That's his idea, in a legitimate way. So what does he say? He says, well, you know, we'll do this. We'll say, you know, when you report profits, the only way I will accept your report is you make it by means of an oath. You have to swear that these are the profits that were made. And we just presume that a religious Jew does not like to make oaths. He like avoids them. He doesn't want to make shvuos. So I say to you, you know, if you don't want to make the oath, so, you know, we anticipate a certain profit from this business. If you'll give me this sum of money on a monthly basis, I will be satisfied that this is my prorated share of the profits, and I won't ask any further questions. If you don't want to make the oath, I'll give you another option that you could buy off your obligation to make this oath by agreeing to pay me this sum, which is what it should come out to be, my share of the profits should practically come out to this anyway, so I will accept it. So we just presume that the managing partner will not want to take the oath, and therefore it will trigger the schar's pashrus, and therefore this guy will get his profits that he's anticipating. See, but that 1555, what about today? No, so Rav Moshe Tzatzal, he and others that have written about this, say, like, why wouldn't somebody not want to take an oath? What's so predictable about that? People would take an oath and say, sorry, there was no profits this month. That's it. I don't have to pay you anything. Well, there were $10 profits. And is it beyond people to take false oaths? You know, it's not so partial that people would be afraid to take oaths today, same way they were 500 years ago. It's not so partial. So Rav Moshe says, you know what? And this is interesting. No one picked up on this in the forms of Het Iskog. Rav Moshe just suggests that you can make the oath a lot more scary, and then people will be afraid to take the oath. You say, you know, I want you to keep us chavis. Take the oath, holding the Sefer Torah, Ben Asher Lohosim, before, you know, when people, and we have a public reading in the Torah, Monday and Thursday, just before you take back the Sefer Torah. Hold the Sefer Torah, make an oath, quickly. So a lot of people wouldn't want to do that, you know. And then you say, also, a person could accept klolos on himself. If I'm lying, I accept curses upon myself. That's where Moshe writes in the Tshuva. And surprisingly, no one picked up on this at all, that this idea. And some say, all right, so that's what Nachum Mendel of Vigdis talked about, an oath. Then he said, what about the losses? He said, the only way I will believe you that there were losses is you must produce Aiden. So this went through different stages. They first had to ask, because he had what was called Aiden Yiduim. They designate certain people that only these people I accept your testimony. That's just right for total mockery of this whole thing, because some people used in the early days of Het Iskog, they used the Rav and the Chazan of the Kehillah. They will have to testify how your business is. How in the world are they going to know about how the business is? So you're making like impossible. You cannot establish impossible conditions. So then you're just making a mockery of this whole thing. That impossible conditions. So they use the Rav and the Chazan. But today, all the Het Iskog forms, they don't use Eidim Yiduim, designated witnesses. They use Eidim Kasherim. They say witnesses that are kosher, which is also very strict. But see, I think, to be honest about it, like, you want to do a really honest job. So if somebody is a business, you know he's going to use money for a certain business. So then you would take even the employees of the business and say, as long as they're accepted, again, the Negias, you know, say, we accept their testimony. But no one does this. They just write Adam Sherim. And the question is, is this really an impossible condition? Because, you know, in Bati Dinam, a lot of times you accept, you know, Bataris Umdana, not, you know, as part of the building the case, you would accept witnesses' testimony from women, from Not as Torah's Adas, but you would build up whether there's an umdana or not by accepting witness testimony from all kinds of people that are not kosher in Torah to say Adas. But anyway, that's how he fixed it up. And he wants to make it predictable that what will happen, that the managing partner will not want to take the oath,
and he will not be able to convince the Edomim to do him. Okay, so that way the financier will get what he's looking for. Now the question is, Rabbi Moshe says, it's not a kameya. The hetiska is not a kameya, an incantation that magically works. It has to make sense. So really the question is, if you're doing the standard type of hetiska, which is chasi mil v'chasi b'kodem, that's how you're setting it up, and then you're saying, you have to give me 50% of the profit, 50%, I accept 50% of the losses, but you have to verify this, the profits through oath, and the losses through witnesses, right? So what happens if you want to get like a very high return that is much higher than ordinary businesses would make? Like I want to get like a 15% return, let's say. So it would seem that this can't be, the profit has to be double that, because I'm saying if my share is 50%, so the business did really great, 30% profit. So how do you expect the business to do that well? This whole thing is to be a sham. How could you write that you want to get a certain size pashas, which amounts to, if you take it percentage wise, a 30% return on the whole business and 15% for my share, I get half, right? How could you say that? So Black, in his writings of Hetter Iskov, he points out that there's a very important thing, that and Rabbi Moshe says this also, that, but not in answer to this question, but generally says it's not a good idea if you take the Hetter Iskov seriously, that is that to actually specify the business that the Misasik intends to invest money in. It's not a good idea to do that. To just say, generally, I'm giving you money, you go and buy merchandise or anything, investments that will be for the benefit of both of us, in very very general terms. Not to specify what exactly is. Like, you're tempted to do, though. If you're a financier, like, you know, you want to give money to somebody to buy a house, for example. So you want to make sure that the fellow used the money for what you're giving it for. You're very tempted to say, like, write it into the document that's what you're going to use the money for. But it's a very bad idea to do that, because the only reason why this works is because it's predictable. Now, what would happen if what we call a self-evident loss happens? Let's say that the iska is determined. It's written in the Shara Het Iska. It is a house that you bought, which is certainly an iska because it appreciates in value, right? Even though you live in it, still it appreciates. It is an iska, right? So what happens if there's a real estate slump and over a period of time that it's a W-dua? Like anyone will testify that the real estate values went down. So meaning that there was no profit, and in fact there were even losses. So, and we have a monthly statement that the Misasik has to do paying these sums. Like the financier is expecting that he will receive his Schachis Pashas, this compromised sum, right? By clockwork. He will expect to get it, and he will not want to take the Shvuah, and he won't be able to produce the witnesses. He'll get the sum that he's looking for. But what happens in this period of time if there was a self-evident loss? So and so the financier cannot demand that someone should take an oath on something which is Yadua Lakol. In other words, there is no obligation to make an oath when it's done with Yadua. It would be a Shvua Shav. It would be an oath in vain. I should make a Shvua. There was no. Why should I make an oath when everyone knows it? It would be called a Shvua Shav, an oath uttered in vain. So the financier has no right to demand an oath, and therefore there's no triggering of the Schachis Pashas, because I don't have to buy off my privilege. If I don't want to make an oath, I have to buy it off by giving the Schachis Pashas. But I have no obligation in the first place to make an oath when it's a Yadua Lakol. So the whole thing breaks down. The financier does not get what he's looking for at all. So if you specify what the iska is, that is a very bad idea. And all the forms, the headers, they don't specify. Somebody wants to outsmart these forms. It's not a good idea to do that. And that would explain our other question of how can you write for yourself a schachis pashas that is such a large sum of money. When you figure it out, it would amount to a very high rate of return, which most businesses will never make, not even close, right? So the answer is, you're not specifying the iska. So the person has freedom to do whatever he wants. This is what Rabbi Black says. including speculation in the stock market, commodity markets, derivatives. You could do, people can make a killing very quickly there, you know. So it makes great sense that a person can do whatever he wants and for the benefit of both, he's allowed to do that. So that's how you get around that. So see what are there any questions about it? Yeah.
So how does this help when I have an Israeli savings account?
So now you ask a very good question. See, question is, what is an iskar? That is, how broadly do we define iskar? And see, there's a big machlokas here. Shaul Meitshev takes a very unusual idea. He says that he defines an iskar as any activity that saves a person time from and saves a person an expense. That's how he defines an iskar. So if a person is now owns a home and he's going to be forfeiting the home because he's delinquent in paying the mortgage, and the bank will just auction off his home. You lend him money, he can make the payments, so he won't have to lose his home and spend time renting. So you're saving this fellow who's giving him money, but Torah Siska, he doesn't have any business at all, no business at all. He just needs his personal needs. He needs to prevent bankruptcy and prevent his loss of his home. So you are saving him an expense, and the expense would be to lose his home and go and to rent a home. So he would have to incur this expense of renting this way. No, I don't have to rent. I can keep my home. So that's considered to be an iskar, saving someone an expense. Another idea, he says. Suppose somebody he gives an example of a malamed, and he has a lot of debts, and he can't really manage with his salary to pay all his expenses. So if you don't give him a loan to stabilize him, he would have to leave his parnasa, his livelihood, and take on another job. So he would lose his job, and he would have to look for another job. So this is considered to be saving the fellow time and expense of, and see, and he says it even the third case of someone who is a balchov. So if you don't give him the loan, he would have to go and somehow collect money from different people. He would have to have a tircha. You have to go and you're saving him from this time expenditure of looking for people to help him out by you giving him the money. So it's all this is considered, like, in a very broad sense, this is an iskar, saving someone expenses and saving someone's time and energy, that he won't have to do certain things because he has the money. You're stabilizing him. He doesn't have to exert himself or expend his money. So that is a very broad definition of iskar. And so the Bris Yehuda mentioned that sefer of Yaakov Yishayahu Blau, that he quotes a lot of authorities like the Minchas Yaakov, the Minchas Yitzchak. A lot of the Achronim argue with the Shaul Meitshev, and they say an iskar has to be something that earns money. It could be merchandise, it could be stocks and bonds, it could be a house. It has to be something that generates either income or capital appreciation. In the conventional way that we understand a business, that's what it is. And you can't say, if you save someone an expense or save him time and effort that he otherwise would have to exert himself, that's also an iskar. That's too broadly. But surprisingly, you know, when you look at his discussion that Bris Yehuda has and all the achronim that he brings, you would think that he would say that we reject the Shaul Meitshev, that he's not like a yachid, like he doesn't have a lot of support. It's a very peculiar idea of how to define iskar. So, but he doesn't say that. He says ain lo hechra. He said we can't decide the matter. It is we can't decide the matter at all. So in other words, we can't. People could people actually use het iska for this purpose. No. So there is a whole issue today about banks. There are a lot of Jewish banks today, like the Apple Bank is a Jewish bank, an Independence Bank, and they there's others also that they so how do they transact? So they have a heter iska klali, which is what it is called, and this is a very interesting innovation that was proposed by Rav Label Eger in 1924 of Lublin. He proposed it in a rabbinical journal, this concept of heter iska klali. And so the idea is that someone would just make an announcement once in the beginning of his business career that all my business transactions should be done on basis of heter iska. And that would permit him to, that moidor would allow him to do all his business without saying anything. So this was a controversial idea, whether we should accept this or not. And see, many would accept it when it comes to the same person, like you have a certain client, you're dealing with him again and again and again. So, all right, some Rabbanim, but when it's Brisker who brings this down, they would accept that to that extent. But to say that whoever I do deal business with, and I don't say anything to them, that is a chiddush gadol. But a lot of Rabbanim, it seems like the exigencies of the time, that they agreed to this, that you could do this, Aaron Kotler and Rav Yisrael Meltzer, his father-in-law, they both disagreed. They didn't go along with this rule that there's such a thing as had to iska klal. But surprisingly, this is like all the Israeli banks. They have had iska klal, and it really is not. It's better than what Rav Eger, what he said of Lublin, because when a bank puts in its bylaws, that do people really investigate the bylaws? People just say whatever they are, I agree to them. No one makes an investigation of what they are. So if Heter Iska is part of their bylaws, so it's not worse than anything else that they have, that very esoteric and obscure things that they have about what you're agreeing to becoming a depositor in the bank. This would be part of their bylaws. See, but the only problem is, and this is definitely a problem, is with the Het Iska Klali, is that according to the American law, the banking laws, they do not allow banks to enter into partnerships with customers. There's no such a thing like that. That violates law. So this is really Het Iska is a type of partnership. But I think that there is a solution here, because it's not, is it really a partnership, Het Iska? In American law, it would be called not a partnership. It would be called a non-recourse loan, because this is the most peculiar business that you ever heard of, this Het Iska business. Because is there an actual partnership in a business, in a real business? Is a business even specified on documents? I mentioned before, it's not a good idea to specify. All the forms, they don't specify any kind of business. And the idea of actually sharing profits in some business only happens if the person does not, it doesn't opt to pay the schar hispashrus. If he wants to make the oath and he wants to bring the witnesses, then he will. You could argue that there's some kind of business that is proper to being. Otherwise, you're just making a payment. That's all. And what kind of business is there really a partnership in? That there is no business, and certainly nobody wants to be as a professor Reznikov, who wrote a very important article about how the secular courts, where they would interpret Het Iska, says that there's certainly no desire on the part of the parties that get into Het Iska that there should be any kind of real partnership in any kind of real business. Suppose a guy takes the money that he's got from the financier and he puts in his business, and he does he he becomes guilty of polluting the environment, and he's subject to huge fines from the EPA. So you're partners. You have to share in all these fines. There's no such intention at all. That I should become a partner in your business. Giving you revachim, I'm giving you problems. What it is akin to het iska is what is called a limited partnership. There's a fellow that manages the business and he makes all decisions. He has a liability, and the other people that give money are only going to be recipients of profits if there are profits, and they only have limited liability to the extent of their investment, and that's it. It is the closest form of business structure that is like the head discount, but it's called limited partnership, where the actual managers, they are people that are totally liable, and they're the managers, and the other people are merely investors, and they get a claim if there are profits. So really what it amounts to is that the het iska is not a real partnership. It is just a type of loan relationship, which is, you could call, a non-recourse loan. That under certain conditions, you wouldn't have to pay back the loan altogether. So that is really what it is. And so therefore, I think it rescues the whole thing that the banks, they're not really violating the law, banking laws, by having the het iska. Okay, I think we ran out of time. Okay, so we'll stop here. Okay, a little more, but.
The ancient law allows limited liability partnerships?
Who?
The ancient law. You said they don't allow partnerships. They allow limited
liability. Oh, no, that's what, it's an ordinary type of business. Very common business.
Form in America. Limited partnerships with banks. You said that they don't allow partnerships from banks to customers.
Well, see, they don't have to. We don't need that. We don't have to be limited. Isn't it America?
Yeah.
You don't have to make a limited partnership. The idea that we should really call the whole etzer non-recourse loan, you know, it's the dog and your laws, that's really what we're doing.
It's most akin to that as opposed to a limited liability partnership.
It's not a limited liability, but it's like a non-recourse loan. It's something that could be done, but it's probably very, involves a lot of complications to actually set it up that way. It's not necessary. It's just necessary to view it as a non-recourse loan. That's what we're doing. Unless they can do that with all the customers.
Also, just, again, back to the question, to that, I lend him the money, I give him the money.
No, lending, you're giving
him the money.
I'm
your
partner.
So now I get a certain amount of profit.
You're the financier?
Yes.
Yeah.
I get a certain amount of profit, and he gets, because he's paying me for not taking the loan, and he's getting whatever other profits there are.
Well, you agree to what the profit is divisionally, 50-50, whatever it has to be spent.
And then I get it. So even with the law, even with the shura, to prevent the shura, it has to be symmetrical. Even if he's paying me the money to prevent the shura, it's symmetrical.
That's
or then either way, he's getting
it. Still symmetrical, because this reporting method, if I don't object to this reporting method, the financial gives you an option of satisfying his anticipated profits with a certain sum of money. And we relieve you of the duty to make the bargain with you.
And when I want a partnership, he either gives me back all the rest of the money and he becomes a
partner. Well, yes, because it's return. Once the term is over, then you have to return the money that he gave you. You have to return the principal. Thank you.